So I'm very happy to see everyone here this evening, especially so many familiar faces and those over the weekend. The title of tonight's talk is The Planning Mind. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a little bit of a conversation between the Buddha and somebody. And this somebody says to the Buddha, "How come your devotees, your disciples, seem so calm and so luminous and so radiant?" And what the Buddha says is, they are this way because they do not lament over the past. They do not hanker for things in the future. They maintain themselves on whatever comes. Therefore, they are serene. They do not lament over the past. They do not hanker over things in the future. They maintain themselves on whatever comes. Therefore, they are serene. Someone I know once asked a monk who was 80 years old, "Where does your mind go when it is not on the breath?" Kind of an impudent question. And this monk said, "It goes to sex." You have to admire the sense of liveliness in that answer with an 80-year-old renunciate who has been a monk for many, many years. For us, oftentimes where our minds go when we're not in the here and now is to planning, right? Oftentimes it goes to planning. It could be planning to have sex, but it is definitely going to planning. We plan what we are going to say, what we are not going to say, what we're going to wear, what we're going to do, what we're going to eat. We plan what we want to read and what we want to get rid of. We plan what we want to buy. We plan what we want to get done, what we want to become. We plan who we're going to talk to and who we're going to not talk to. We plan who we're going to call and who we're going to email. And the list goes on and on and on. And you can add to this list. It can be quite extensive. We plan and we rehearse our conversations. We find ourselves explaining. We find ourselves describing, asking, pleading, demanding, shouting, defending. We happen to be a society of list makers. We make lists. How many of you in this room make lists? Exactly. And now we have the computer and there's lists on the computer. You know, we make lists. We find ourselves, even when we're on vacation, planning. You know, we're supposed to be relaxing and having a good time, and yet we're making lists and planning what we're going to do. And a very funny thing for those of you, and I know many of you in this room are very familiar with retreats, we find ourselves planning even when we're on retreat and we're being told ad nauseum to be present right here and right now. You know, somebody's nagging us from moment to moment saying, "Be here, you know, be present." And yet we find ourselves planning. We find ourselves still making lists and planning how the day is going to go. I don't know if anyone here has spent a retreat where one wakes up in the morning and kind of manages the retreat. You know, it's kind of frightening to have this seeming concept of a day stretching out in front of you. And so one plans, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that, and then maybe by 3 o'clock I'll get enlightened, and then, you know, this and that. And it goes on and on and on. And in this process, oftentimes we find ourselves making lists. Sometimes we make lists about what we're going to do after the retreat. Sometimes we make lists about what we find out are new desires that evolve during a retreat. I remember after one retreat many years ago, before I started renouncing making lists on retreat, which was a particular practice in and of itself, I went into the office at the Insight Meditation Society after a fairly long retreat, and I went up to the person in the office and I started talking about, you know, I needed this cushion and I wanted to get that cushion and this blanket and, you know, this whole thing. And she looked at me and she said, "Everybody's got a list. You know? All yogis have lists." She was so used to it. I thought it was my list and an important list. But it turns out I was a kind of in a long lineage of lists. Planning is very much a habit. And on the other hand, it is true that it is necessary to plan. We know that it's necessary to plan. You planned to come tonight. You wouldn't have gotten here if you didn't reflect and think about it and plan to get here. Planning really is necessary. And sometimes we can misunderstand the teaching. You know, when we hear, "Let go of planning, of the planning mind," and then we think, well, what else can I do? You know, I need to plan to keep my life together. Once at CIMC, the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center where I teach, there was someone there who went through one of our beginner classes, and he loved it. He enjoyed it very, very much. And then at the end, it was about an 8-week class, and at the end, of course, we did what I'm sure Rodney does here, which is we ask how things went and how the class went and whether it was enjoyed and if you plan on continuing and this kind of thing. So when it got to this particular man, he said, "I really loved the class. I really enjoyed the meditation, but unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do it anymore. I'm going to have to stop." And so, of course, there was some puzzlement about this. If you really loved it, why would you have to stop? And he said, "Well, the problem is that I'm a city planner for Cambridge." And so, kind of missed the point. "So how can I continue to practice being in the now and continue with my livelihood? I've got to continue to plan." So this is a misunderstanding, because planning is clearly necessary in our life, and it's part of many different jobs that we may have. Certainly, planning is a part of being a parent. You can't be a parent without planning. Oftentimes, children are very much in the present moment and not really so great at planning. And, you know, one of our roles and responsibilities is to plan for our children. So it's not as if we have to let go of planning. We may sometimes think that it's not necessary to plan. I know my husband actually wishes that I would plan a little bit more than I do. If we don't take responsibility for planning for what is necessary in life to hold it together, others do end up having to do it with us. And we can be quite deluded about the conditions in our life that need to be taken care of. Sometimes we can have a fear of planning. And because of this fear, there can be aversion. And we can procrastinate. And this can be a habit that we can get into. Instead of the planning mind, the non-planning mind, the mind that procrastinates. We can avoid what we need to do in terms of planning because of fear or because of anxiety. The problem is that avoidance always causes problems in some way at some point. It's not a way out. So a practice, if one notices that one does procrastinate, is to see if one can plan and at the same time be mindful of anxiety. In other words, take it on as a practice to not procrastinate, yeah? But at the same time, see if it's possible to be aware and mindful of anxiety, of fear. see if we can make it into a practice not to put off what needs to be planned. We may try to make decisions and not be able to. And because of this, find that we're confused, or there's doubt occurring, or we're second-guessing ourselves. For smaller decisions that we need to make in our life, it's very, very important to try to get behind the decisions that we do make. You know, to see if instead of dwelling in the second-guessing and in the doubt, to see if it's possible to follow it through and to get behind ourselves with the decisions, the many different decisions that may seem utterly significant that don't matter at all. You know what I mean. See if it's possible to really get behind yourself with these kinds of decisions that have to be made, and then to remain mindful of reactions. Yeah? To see if one can stay with oneself in the midst of the reactions that might arise. Living the decision out, living the choice out, instead of going back and forth and making it significant when it isn't so significant. Investigating, and then perhaps making the opposite decision next time. You know, doing something different next time instead of doing the same thing over and over and over again. You know? And then seeing if it's possible to be aware and mindful. With the larger, bigger decisions that we need to make in life, it is oftentimes necessary to step aside a bit and listen. Just to listen very clearly and deeply to the different colliding voices in our minds. One voice saying, yes, do it, and the other voice saying, if you do it, you'll be crazy, and the other voice saying, I don't want to decide either way. Yeah? And you want to step aside and let the voices fight it out. You know, you don't have to get so interfere with it or get so mixed up in it. Because oftentimes what happens when we do need to make decisions is one voice occurs, and then we really get behind that one voice, and we create a whole thesis about it and a whole reason for why we've made that decision. And then the next voice comes in and says, and, but, you know, and the same thing happens where we get behind that voice, and then that seems utterly reasonable. And then the other voice comes in, you know, and so they're just fighting and colliding. And we need to, as I say, step aside and let the voices fight it out until wisdom arises. Seeing if we can not take sides and ask instead what is fueling each voice. Yeah? Is desire fueling this voice? Is aversion fueling this voice? Is confusion and delusion fueling this voice? And can we wait? Can we be patient until wisdom arises? Compassion and wisdom arise. And these are true guides in our life. There's a very wonderful kind of passage by Dogen in a book that has to do with giving instructions to a Zen cook. So kind of how a cook who was practicing Zen would cook. And it has to do with balance in terms of planning. The instructions offered are to, the night before one is going to make the next day's meal, to plan and to decide what ingredients are necessary and how many ingredients are necessary, to decide exactly what needs to be done for the next day, and to do it in a wholehearted way, in a thoughtful way, yeah, in an impeccable way, to completely decide what that next day's dinner is going to be, with the understanding that it may not ever happen. This is balance, You know, this is balance. To do it with one's whole heart, you know, as one needs to do, to prepare. And in the midst of it, to completely let go. With the recognition that we have no idea whether tomorrow is going to come. We never do. We think we do. You know, we live in that way, but we don't. So not to plan that it's not going to come, you know, to plan as if it will come and to do whatever we need to do. And at the same time, to live in the reality that we don't know even the next moment, let it go, let alone the next day. When we look at planning, one of our questions might be, and I think a really important question, is when is planning necessary? You know, when is it functional? When is it necessary? And when is it habitual and obsessive? And when we're sitting, you know, sitting and we don't have to do anything, and we're not supposed to be doing anything, and we're planning away, obviously, this is an example of when planning is habitual and obsessive. But we can see it. We can see it throughout our day as well, not just in the sitting, of course. Retreats and sittings do reveal what is happening in our minds. Retreats and sittings really can reveal the difference between planning that is necessary and functional and planning that is habitual and obsessive. The intention to be present reveals where we enjoy dwelling. We can see, we can notice for ourselves where the mind enjoys hanging out, enjoys dwelling, you know, where what we like to think about in the midst of the container of the sittings or of a retreat. On a retreat, of course, we can, as I said before, easily fall into planning the day, or we can plan our life. Yeah? Oftentimes this happens where one moves into planning one's life. An aspect of this lineage, as well as retreat life, but of course I'm sure most of you are used to that in the environment here as well, is this form that we use that we call interviews. And of course, for the few of you who might not be familiar with the word interview, what it means is a one-on-one meeting with a teacher. But it really is, we have to admit, kind of a weird word, interview. You know, it sounds like you had better plan before you go into an interview, you know? It sounds like somebody's going to ask you, you know, are you fit to practice or do you deserve to practice or something like that. They're going to interview you to see if you can continue to, you know, be with your breathing or watch your mind or something like that. It's an odd word. Once at the Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, we have a sign there that says, you know, this is an interview room and interviews are here and there's a map and, you know, we have two places that we offer interviews. So this person came for one of our public sittings for the first time and he saw a sign that said interviews. And he asked the person who was hanging around downstairs with him, he said, well, I really need a job. What's being offered? Luckily, they told him before he came in to ask what was being offered. But of course, what is really a better word for interview would be an interview, right? Because it's two people looking inwardly at the experience that is occurring with one person. Yeah. I actually tried to change it in my early days at teaching. There was the word interview up and then, you know, the list of people's names. And I actually put interviews instead. And someone thought I made a mistake and they crossed it out and put interview instead. I should try it now, many years later, to see if the same thing would happen. habitual planning is quite compelling, as we know. It's quite seductive, as we know. It can be very pleasant. It can feel very pleasant to plan. Planning to get things done is oftentimes a whole lot more satisfying than actually doing them. You can plan to clean your house, and there can be a lot of satisfaction in that. And it's totally different than actually picking up the sponge and doing it, right? We can even plan to do something really nice, and the planning itself to do something really nice is more fun than the actuality of it. You know, because the actuality of it, of course the actuality of anything, is it's changing. And the weather changes, and it's not sunny when you want it to be sunny, or the person that you're with, you've planned on that person being a certain way. You know? And that person is slightly different or in a bad mood or not quite the way you want them to be. But the planning is always incredibly enjoyable. You know? Even planning to go out to eat and have something really yummy to eat. You know, the planning of it can be very, very satisfying. And then one is in the actual experience itself, and it's just bite by bite. You know? And it's really just what it is. It can be quite pleasant to plan. Sometimes when we're sitting, it's so much more fun than being with the breathing to enjoy the planning mind. It's really, I think, important to notice what its function is when there is this kind of pleasant planning. We can see that it's a way to avoid being bored. You know, we're so afraid of being bored. And so bringing up planning and thinking about more and more things that we have to do and be and get and this and that can be a way to protect ourselves from having to experience boredom. Sometimes we plan, the function can be to use up time until we get to the real thing. And the real thing is always what's not happening right now. You know, we're sitting planning to walk sometimes. You know, we're walking planning to sit. Not very thrilling. You know, we're sitting planning to eat. We're eating planning to eat again at another point. You know, it's always never the real thing. You know, it's always in another moment that the real thing exists. When actually, as we know, this is never true. Sometimes we plan, and this is the funny thing to see, but sometimes we plan as a way to avoid being lonely, you know, kind of conjuring up relationships in our minds, people to talk to, and people to plan talking to, plan having conversations with, so that we won't feel so alone, so we'll have some company. Sometimes we plan as well as a way to secure a future, to think that we'll know what is going to happen when we always can't know. It's kind of a futile effort to control that which is uncontrollable. As Epictetus said, there is only one way to happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things that are beyond the power of our will. And what is beyond the power of our will is the very next moment. Now, habitual planning is actually not planning. And we use this word planning, and it sounds good, and it's kind of an elegant term. But actually, habitual and obsessive planning is in reality either worry or fantasy. Yeah? Yeah. And it really helps to see it as it is, because if we call it planning and it's actually worrying or fantasizing, then we'll feel somehow justified in continuing it. We'll feel compelled to continue because, of course, we have to plan. But who has to worry? Who has to fantasize? You know, it kind of cuts away at it a bit to see it more clearly as it is. If we see it more clearly as it is, it allows us to let go of it more easily, more smoothly. We're not able or willing to let it go if we think that it's necessary to continue with. And so the tendency is to perpetuate it, to dwell in what we're calling planning, that which is actually worrying or fantasizing, in not seeing it as it is. Now, there are two ways to discern for yourself whether what is happening in your mind is planning, in which case, go to town, or whether it is indeed worrying or fantasizing. There are two really good ways to find this out for yourself. The first way is to ask, is it repetitive? Is it repetitive? Because actually, to plan more than once makes it a worry or a fantasy. We only have to plan once. And when we repeat that plan over and over and over and over, and you know how much over it can be, you know, times 1 million sometimes, then it is not a plan. So this is one way to find out for yourself, to discern for yourself, is this indeed a plan, you know, and get behind it and do it if it is, or is it repetitive? The other way to discern for yourself is to see if you can be aware of the feeling tone that is occurring. Now, there's a feeling tone sometimes that is happening. In other words, to be aware of the anxiety or the desire that is accompanying the so-called plan. Now, the feeling tone that is there. So in other words, if worry is occurring, the feeling tone is going to be unpleasantness. There's going to be an unpleasant feeling tone when worry is happening. There's going to be some sense of anxiety. Even if it's low-level anxiety, you can catch it, you know, anxiety or fear. So when the feeling tone is unpleasant, worry is occurring. It's not a plan. On the other hand, when the feeling tone is pleasant, when it feels enjoyable, then it's a fantasy. So you now, I mean, this is really, really helpful, because you now have two ways to discern for yourself, to see what is actually happening. You know, is a planning happening, or is worry happening, in which case there'll be unpleasant feeling tone, you know, anxiety, fear, but it won't feel good. There'll be some degree of a kind of a quiver somewhere in your body, you know. Or is there a pleasantness occurring? Is the feeling tone pleasant? Do you want to continue with it? You know, will you feel deprived if you have to let it go? You know? Because planning itself is actually neutral. There's no feeling tone when there's an actual plan, when there's something that we're doing that we have to be doing. You know, the feeling tone itself is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's neutral. We're not getting anything out of it. You know, it's just what needs to be done. So looking more closely at worry itself, I want to talk a little bit more about worry. We worry so much about so many things. We worry about our health. We worry about the health of our loved ones. We worry about our friends. We worry about our family. We worry about our possessions. We worry about our income. We worry about our job. We worry about the world. And the list of worries goes on and on. We worry sometimes about whether we're good enough. About whether we're good enough versus what our practice allows us to see, which is goodness emerging. As we look more clearly with awareness, we see that goodness emerges as we let go of the inner obstructions. This is very, very different than the effort to be good, which is based on convention. To read you something from Mary Oliver, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. No, you do not have to be good. We need to trust in goodness emerging. This is a radical difference. There is ease in trusting in goodness emerging. There is anxiety, endless anxiety and doubt in trying to conform and contort ourselves into our ideas of what it means to be good. We can as well worry quite a bit about how we are being perceived by others. This can be a fairly strong neurotic worry. And I like something that Ethel Barrett said. We would worry less about what others think of us if we realized how seldom they do. Perspective, you know, bringing in a sense of perspective. One question is it possible, can we experience the anxiety and the fear that is underlying the thoughts of worry? You know, because we can be aware that worrying is happening, that thoughts of worry are occurring. And it can be very superficial, kind of endlessly superficial, endlessly tormenting, but endlessly superficial nonetheless, with an underlying sense of unpleasantness that we don't want to contact. So we stay on the superficial level of thinking. So one question, when we are experiencing thoughts of worry, no matter how much you think that you worry or find that you're worrying throughout the day, because it's a habit, it's a conditioned habit, to see if it's possible to just go under a little bit, not like diving deep, just a little bit underneath to explore the underlying anxiety and discomfort. You know, to see if it's possible to embrace the unpleasantness, to embrace the discomfort, to be less afraid of experiencing discomfort. Because if we can do this, if we can experience the discomfort, if we can open to it and embrace it, we see that it changes. We see that it's actually not so big to be afraid of, so much to be afraid of, because it occurs and then it changes. It exists and then it dissolves. And it's very different than keeping it continuing and hooked in by simply staying on the superficial level of thought. So this is a question for us if we find that a lot of worrying is occurring. Can we ask, is it necessary to worry? Will worrying help this situation, no matter how worrisome the situation may be? Is it worthwhile? Will it help myself or others? The Dalai Lama would definitely say no. If you have some fear of pain or suffering, you should examine whether there is anything you can do about it. If you can, there is no need to worry about it. If you cannot do anything, then there is also no need to worry. It's closing all the options there. You know? If there's a reason for worry, well, if you can't do anything about it, then it's going to be extra torment, added torment. There's going to be the situation and the worry instead of just the situation. Yeah? And then if you can do something about that, then you do something about that and you don't add that extra torment of worry. Mahagosananda said this. We may notice that the vase of flowers on the table is very beautiful, but the flowers never tell us of their beauty. We never hear them boast of their sweet scent. When a person has realized liberation, it is the same. He or she does not have to say anything. We can sense his beauty, her sweetness, just by being there. There is no need to worry about the past or the future. The secret of happiness is to be entirely present with what is in front of you, to live fully in the present moment. You can't go back and reshape the past. It's gone. You can't dictate the future, so there is no need to worry. The next time I fly in an airplane, who knows what will happen? Maybe I will arrive safely, or maybe I won't. When we make plans, we can make them only in the present moment. This is the only moment we can control. We can love this moment and use it well. Past suffering can never harm us if we truly care for the present. Take care of the present and the future will be well. The Dharma is always in the present, and the present is the mother of the future. Take care of the mother, and the mother will take care of her child. Many times, what we are worrying about is not happening now. It's not happening right now. And the practice allows us to develop confidence that we'll know what to do when it's needed, when we need to move, when we need to act, when we need to speak. The practice offers us the confidence that we will indeed know what to do. Our energy is freed for wiser action. If we're locking it all up in thoughts of worry, we don't have enough energy to be able to see what actually needs to be done when something needs to be done. There's a really big difference between worrying about others and caring for others. There's a really big difference between worrying about ourselves and caring for ourselves. There's a world of difference in between these two. We may sometimes feel that it's almost our duty or our obligation to worry. You know, at least we care. At least it's a signal to us that we're not indifferent and that we don't care. At least we're doing something. Because, of course, with worrisome situations, we oftentimes feel very helpless and sometimes paralyzed. And so we think we can do something if we're worrying about it. You know, it signifies that we're caring. However, so much better to replace worry with loving kindness. This is actually really doing something. This is the difference between worrying and caring for, and truly does have an impact. Better to extend loving kindness when we find ourselves worrying. Now, may you be safe. May you be free from danger. May you live in love and in compassion. May I be safe. May I be free from danger. May I live in love and in compassion. And in this way, we are allowing for a wholeness of heart instead of the fragmented approach of worrying that actually, as we know, does not have a real impact on any situation. When we notice that worrying is occurring and we move into metta instead, when we move into loving kindness instead, we are using our life well. We are using our hearts well. And we are actually able to have some kind of an impact, even if that impact is only to help our own hearts to stay calm. Then we are able to offer help to ourselves and to others in the midst of a calm instead of worried heart. When we think that we're planning, but there's actually that undertone of pleasantness, this is when fantasizing is happening. So I want to say a little bit about fantasizing as well. So when it feels good, when it's enjoyable, this is when fantasy is occurring. Fantasy is an effort, really a futile effort, to not experience life in the here and now. It is true that we will actually be able to actualize some of our fantasies. Not all of our fantasies, of course, but once in a while at least, we'll be able to actualize a fantasy or two, and we will still always be here and now because there's no other place to be. Kind of like today is the tomorrow you fantasized about yesterday. I can't remember the real motto. Does anyone remember? I think it's today is the tomorrow you planned about yesterday. Something like that. Nobody knows this. Maybe it's a cliche that is not really a cliche, and it only is to me. But anyway, today is the tomorrow. It's good if it's fresh. Today, today is the tomorrow that you fantasized about yesterday. So you could also say, of course, today is the tomorrow that you worried about yesterday. Either one will do. But in any case, you know, that's what we're doing right now about tomorrow, is we're worrying or we're fantasizing. But yesterday, we were doing the same thing about today. You know? So we can be completely caught in this. And it's not that it's so easy, of course, to be in life as it is here and now. You know? I mean, we have reasons for fantasizing. We feel that we need a break, you know, from real life to move into fantasy. Yeah? There's reasons for it. I just remember one time on a retreat when I was having it was a long retreat and it was freezing cold. And I was really having a very hard time. And I got a postcard from my father. And the postcard said something like, you know, hello, dear. Your mother and I are having fun, and we just want to have fun. You know, kind of like, you know, this kind of fantasy. And here I am, freezing cold, and not enough blankets, and stuck with myself. Nothing was really wrong, of course, but stuck with my own mind, which was not at that point a very happy place to be. You know? And so, of course, the urge to fantasize. In looking more deeply, though, we can see the limits of fantasy, and we're more willing to let go of this pleasantness when we can for ourselves see its limits. We can see that it ends. This is a big problem. You know, even with the best fantasy, you can keep it going for a while, but you've always got to come out of it. This is a real problem. You know, fantasies inherently are impermanent. And it's such a poor substitute for joy. It really pales in comparison to real life. You know, when we have a taste of the joy that is possible by remaining present, by sustaining our presentness in the here and now, then fantasy actually loses its power. It becomes not interesting anymore. As Iris Murdoch said, when fantasy ends, human liberation begins. It's really great. When fantasy ends, human liberation begins. You know? In letting go of our attachment to fantasy, there is the possibility of enormous joy. Habitual planning is quite exhausting. It uses energy that is quite precious, that is needed for awareness. It's like doing everything many times instead of just one time. Over and over again, doing the same thing in our mind instead of doing it the one time that we need to do it. As Hafiz said, now that all your worry has proved such an unlucrative business, why not find a better job? It's very helpful to remind oneself that you are here. You know, wherever you are, in whatever moment, you are here. And not, I am here as a concept. You know, this idea, this thought, I am here. But instead, to sense the body, you know, to experience the air touching one's skin, to be aware of sounds around you, you know, to be aware of the environment that one is in, to be aware of being in the presence of others if one is, something that grounds one in the here and now. Asking oneself, am I preoccupied with planning in an effort to avoid right now? Because this is the function of both worry and of fantasy. The practice allows us to gradually strengthen our hearts so that there is not so much need to avoid the here and now. We develop the confidence that this too is workable, whatever this too is in our life in any given moment, that this too is workable, is possible to work with. The limitation of clinging to habitual planning, to worrying and fantasizing, is that nothing new can happen. There is no receptivity because the airways are kind of clogged up. The heart is congested. We're only hearing static. There's no new information that can happen. There's no learning that can occur because the system is closed. You know, with worry, it's like going around in a circle of worry. With fantasy, it's the same thing. We go around in a circle with fantasy. Yeah? So the system is closed and we're not open and available to the beauty in life and what can be learned through living our life in the here and now. We carry worlds around within us, quite private worlds, quite secreted worlds at times of our own making. You know, our fantasies and our worries can be quite secretive and private, and they can be a world unto themselves. In being mindful, there is a release of energy that occurs. It allows us to enter into life, always right here and right now. And then we can ask this profound question, which is, what is the quality of my heart right now? You know? What is the quality of my heart right now? This is a question that can actually break through our worries, that can actually break through our pleasant fantasies. letting go of habitual planning does indeed open up the possibility of knowing for ourselves joy in the here and now. Instead of planning to practice in some other moment, which we can so easily do, you know, I'll practice at another point. I'll practice when things are easier in my life. I'll practice when things are harder. I don't need to practice right now. I'm in love. You know? Oftentimes people leave the practice in that interim time of being thrilled about being in love, and then they come back when things change. I've seen this happen so much. You know? But planning to practice in some other moment is never a good idea. Because we can only practice right here and now. Every moment matters. No matter how long we've been lost for, whenever we remember, this is what matters. This moment is what matters. We can take impermanence to heart and remember that all we can depend upon, all we can really know, is the here and now. And so, really, the only moment we can practice in is the here and now. We can't plan to practice in the future. One of my favorite fantasies years ago used to be planning retreats. I mean, we're all odd in our own way, and my oddness was, and it really was a very pleasant fantasy, I'd be on a retreat planning for the next retreat. Or I'd be on a particular retreat of a particular type, you know, because I sit a lot of different types of retreats. So I'd be on a particular retreat of a certain type, and I'd think about the next retreat that I was planning to do, you know, or could do. You know? And it's so funny. It was so liberating to break through that and to realize that I was just experiencing this pleasure, but it was really blocking me from knowing joy. So we just need to see what our own arenas of pleasure or of worry are. It's really not easy. What I'm saying, this talk is not an easy one, you know, because it's so deeply conditioned within us to worry. And it's so deeply conditioned within us to try to take refuge in pleasure, the pleasure of our own minds. It's deeply conditioned. And so because it's not easy to let go of worrying, to let go of habitual planning, to let go of fantasizing, kindness and wisdom are called for. The kindness required is the recognition that it arises and it's out of our control. Planning arises. Worrying arises. Fantasy arises. And we do not have control over the arising. We can't choose to have a thought that we want to have. You know, this is out of our control. And it's not one's fault that thoughts of fantasy arise and thoughts of worry arise. It's not an inherent problem that any thought arises whatsoever, because we have no choice about this at all. So don't worry about worrying. Now, that's kind of not the point of this talk, to now have a new problem of worrying about worrying or worrying about fantasizing or whatever. It's just that one also wants to have the wisdom, the kindness of understanding that it arises on its own and it's out of our control and it's not personal and it's not your fault. This is the kindness part. The wisdom part is recognizing that we don't have to dwell there. We don't have to live there. We don't have to set up camp. We can recognize that it's suffering and that it's limited, that we don't have to continue with that which is impermanent. So we can see it as it is and not perpetuate it. We can choose something different. You know, so it's the difference between arising and then getting hooked into it and going with it and taking a ride on it and then kind of having to find ourselves a way home, a way back to the here and now. But if we can recognize that it's happening, then we can see, worrying is occurring right now. You know, fantasizing is occurring right now. And now what's occurring right now? Air against the skin is occurring right now. Or sounds are occurring right now, or whatever else is happening. We don't have to continue to add to. You know, we don't have to continue to add thought upon thought upon thought. And this is wisdom. So we learn to nourish ourselves on the present moment instead of feeding on worry and fantasy. Instead of depending on planning for nourishment, we can nourish ourselves on the here and now, just as in the time of the Buddha, as the Buddha's disciples did. Same very thing. We do not lament over the past. We do not hanker for things in the future. We maintain ourselves on whatever comes. Therefore, we are serene. Okay, let's just take a moment and sit together. May all beings have ease of mind. May all beings have comfort of heart. May all beings live in love and in compassion. Okay, so any questions or comments or anything you'd like to ask about? Either it was a remarkably and unusually clear talk, or nobody worries or fantasizes here.
I guess we shouldn't worry about why we're working.
It's unnecessary. Mm-hmm. It's unnecessary because most people do worry until they don't. So it's pretty much like the same thing as being resistant to sitting and trying to figure out why you are. One is in a long lineage of beings who have been resistant to sitting for the last 2,500 years. So you can feel yourself part of the noble ones. You know, it's the same thing, that it doesn't matter. It's the way of things. It's what human beings do. Yeah. Yeah. So no, it's not necessary to worry about worrying.
Just letting go that it counts.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Seeing it, and I would say letting it let go of you. You know, you can't force these things. Yeah, but if you see it, it will gradually dissolve. And if you see how you're adding to it and deliberately perpetuating it, because you actually think it's going to help and you have to. Some of that, seeing through some of that, can help a lot. Because then the trust one has in worrying begins to drop away, and we develop much more trust in awareness. And this is when things really begin to shift, is when we develop more trust in awareness than in our thoughts about things. You know, that's when really things begin to change and move and transform themselves. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, did I?
Can you speak a little bit more about the comfort in worrying that you mentioned?
The comfort in worrying?
Yeah, there's some sort of strange backward cycle.
Yeah. Did you know what I meant by that? Do you feel that yourself at all?
Well, I keep going.
Right. Right, exactly. It's a weird kind of comfort, for sure. Because it is unpleasant, and it does feel torturous at the same time. I think it's comforting because it's familiar. And we're so afraid of the unfamiliar. Oftentimes, we don't even know we're unafraid of the unfamiliar or the unknown. But the fact that we dwell so much in the known is kind of a hint that we're afraid of the unknown. So I think that the familiarity, just the fact that it can feel like good friends, you know, as Ajahn Chah said, he said it's kind of like breaking up with, you know, old childhood friends when you start making changes in this way. You know? So our worries, some of them we've had forever in different forms. You know, we've had the same subject that we've worried about. Sometimes you can even go back to when you were a child and see that there was a hint of it. It wasn't the same thing exactly, but there was a hint of the same thing happening that you were worrying about, and it becomes familiar. And so I think anything that's familiar, like a familiar, you know, blanket or comfort or person or whatever it might be, there can be a clinging to it. Yeah. But see if you can investigate this for yourself, because it's a really good question. So I would be interested and curious and investigative about it. Yeah.
It seems almost like a superstition. Like,
good.
I don't worry about this.
Yes, yes. I think you're right. I think you're right. I think that's good perception. Yes, yes. It's almost like what you're afraid of won't happen if you are, you know, almost like it's almost like a hypervigilance. Instead of an appropriate, you know, loving attentiveness, it becomes a hypervigilance. Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, yeah. But, so you've got to risk, you know, the fact that superstition is superstition. Yeah, you've got to risk letting that go to see, what you are really afraid of, is it really going to happen? Yeah. Call me up. Let me know. Actually, call Rodney. Yeah.
I often find I get a lot of fantasies during a retreat.
Yes.
And especially if after I've been there a few days, and it's almost an aversion to the practice itself.
Exactly.
And I get this almost like, because I'm trying to practice, I've become averse to fantasies as well as the practice itself. So I get stuck there, and I'm having a hard time working on that.
You get the fantasies are happening, and you don't like that they're happening?
Well, yes, that's true. Because when the fantasies are happening, I have an awareness of these fantasies, and I also have this attention for practice.
Right.
And I'm going to the practice.
Right. Yeah. It's like a like you get a little bit of pleasure there. You know, like you get a little bit of a sip of something yummy to drink, but you're not allowing yourself to drink the rest of it.
Right.
Yeah. So you get like a little hit of it, but then you know because you have the intention to not continue with it, you're kind of dragging yourself away from it,
mm-hmm.
Right? But the here and now is not all that enjoyable.
Sure.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I think a great deal of some degree of renunciation really is necessary, you know, because really it's renunciation of suffering. It's not renunciation of pleasure. It's renunciation of maybe you could say the good for the best, you know, like the pleasure for the joy might be one way to put it. So some of that is necessary because you're just going to be endlessly lost in the fantasy if you don't have some intention. So you do have that intention. But then I also think that a really soft patience, and patience is a sustaining of loving kindness, that has to be brought in as well. Yeah. And then I also think that oftentimes when we don't like what's happening, it's because tension is occurring. And we don't know that tension is occurring. So we're trying to be aware of what we think we should be aware of instead of being aware of discomfort and tension. And then the practice would be to see if you can relax into that tension. You know, see if you can notice what is wrong right now. What feels wrong right now? And then to see if you can actually open to that and embrace it and do the opposite of what we instinctually do, which is to move away from it. Yeah. Or maybe one touches it a tiny bit, but there's like a, you know, a hesitation in terms of a real open embracing of it because it's painful. Of the discomfort. Yes. And that really is what's called for, because one is fleeing to fantasy because we think it's a refuge from the discomfort. And, you know, you can do that your whole life. And then we find ourselves in a position where the fantasy doesn't work anymore because something so difficult is happening that the fantasy doesn't have its same power. You know, it doesn't hold us up. We find that the fantasy doesn't hold us up in the same way. And so that kind of understanding can help. Yeah. But I also think that it's just the way the practice is, you know, that fantasy drops away in its own way and in its own time, too. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Okay. Yes.
I have a desire to go to both extremes, just wanting all spontaneous kind of actions, to worrying about the future in 5 years. What's the middle ground between?
Could you just say that again? I couldn't totally hear it.
I have a tendency to want to go to extremes.
Okay.
So just going on a vacation but not planning where I'm going to stay. To what am I going to be doing in 5 years and trying to design a curriculum to get there. And I don't seem to find the middle road between those extremes.
I mean, personally, I don't think that's an extreme to go somewhere and not know where you're going to stay. But then again, as I said, my husband wishes I would plan more. So, but, you know, I mean, that's just life. That's being open to things as they are and appreciating a spontaneity, kind of having a trust in the universe that you're going to be taken care of with something like that, you know, with something like going on vacation. And then, you know, to look at where the five-year plan comes from, is it something that is useful and helpful and not something you're obsessing about? And again, to look at the, you know, the tone quality there, the pleasant and the unpleasant. It's probably pleasant, you know, because it's about possibilities in the future. Anything can happen. But to see if there's something compelling in there or whether it's just helpful, like, you know, planning for retirement or something like that, where if you're attached to it, it's a problem. But if you reflect on it, then it can be a positive thing. Yeah. Anyone else? Yes.
You spoke a little bit about procrastination.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that there's both elements of aversion, for sure, driving that, and not enough clarity or confusion. What is the benefit of procrastination? What do we get out of it?
I don't think there's any benefit. I think it's really a torture. I think it's really torturing oneself.
So why do we keep doing it?
Aversion to having to do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really simple. We don't want to do what we know we need to do. So we put it off as long as we can. Years ago, I used to really not want to make phone calls I used to just not like the phone. And so I would put off making phone calls over and over again. And then I devised what I called an aversion Friday. And every Friday, I had to make all my calls. You know, so at least there was only a week of putting it off in between. And then every Friday, I would set it up so that I had to do what I was procrastinating doing. It felt good. Things weren't lagging as much, you know. But yeah, I think it's aversion, you know. And it's, sometimes it's the fear of committing to something and then having to live that through. Yeah. So look into it, you know. See if you can look into it, because oftentimes we'd rather experience the aversion than the freedom of doing what we need to do. You know, we'd rather. It's a weird thing. And I think there's different reasons, but some of it is just that we're familiar with the aversion, you know, with dragging our feet.
Uncomfortable with the unclarity.
Yeah.
Dwelling in.
Yeah.
Right. You want to think about it.
Exactly. Even though, you know, of course, whatever we don't want to think about, it's like when we have a difficult person and they're there all the time. When we, you know, don't have enough contact with people that we want to have contact with. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing. When we're putting off something, it's there a lot of the time. And then you do it, and then you can let it go. You can drop it. And so then, oh, yeah, wonderful. And then, you know, if you have that as a pattern, then the next thing comes along. So there's kind of always a weight. You're living your life always with some kind of a weight, some kind of a stone that you're dragging along. Yeah. So as a pattern, you know, if you can see it as a habit, as a pattern, as conditioning, it can help a lot to kind of register the relief or the freedom in actually doing it and getting it done and then being able to move on. And that's how we educate our hearts, you know, is through being present from moment to moment. So experiencing the aversion, not pushing the aversion or the discomfort away, but being willing to experience that big stone, you know? And then, of course, experiencing the letting go as well, yeah. And, you know, habits are habits, so gradually we slowly, agonizingly begin to get it. Yeah.
Well, don't you think sometimes procrastination is thinking that as long as you don't make a decision, you won't make a mistake?
It sure can. It sure can. Yes, of course.
Trying to make the right decision.
Yes. Well, I think, again, that if you make a decision, I think it's really important to try to get behind that decision and do it even if you don't want to do it, even if you've made the wrong decision, you know, unless it's something that's going to be really harmful, you know. But if it's something about should I do this or should I do that or all the things that we agonize about that aren't all that important, I think it's really best to try to, as best as one can, as a practice, to stay with that decision that's been made, unless, of course, something comes along and you can't, you know. But to see if you can stay with it, and then be aware of what else is there, of the different mind states that are pulling you away and that are saying, I should have done this or I should have done that or why can't I do that? And then the next time, do something different. You know, and then try that out. Maybe that's just as bad, you know, or just as good. And then you've learned from that. You've learned that it doesn't matter as much as you think. And there's too much emphasis on content and not enough emphasis on the happiness of the heart. You know, not as much emphasis on awareness and too much emphasis on content and decisions and things and form and, you know, thinking it matters so much if I do this or if I do that. And kind of what's pushing you? You know, is it wanting to do the right thing? Is it wanting more pleasure? Is it wanting to be seen in a particular way? Is it wanting to, you know, not feel claustrophobic? You know, there's so many different things that one can see and investigate. So you kind of have to find out for yourself what is going on in that. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so thank you so much. Lovely to see you. And I'll see you again.
Thank you.